If you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly changing around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? What happens when US policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Pride Month is a celebration. We all know that. But at its core, it's also a reminder. A reminder that progress is never guaranteed, that freedom for many in the queer community around the world is still something they are forced to fight for every single day. Pride was born out of protest, out of resistance to systems that denied queer and trans people their basic rights, their dignity, and in many cases, their safety. And that resistance continues, especially in parts of the world where being queer is still criminalized, punished, and persecuted. Today's conversation is about what it means to build safety where there is none, to create change in the face of fear, and to lead with purpose when your very identity puts you at risk. Latoya Nugent is the head of engagement at Rainbow Railroad, a global organization that helps queer people escape persecution and find pathways to safety. But she's not just an advocate, she's also a survivor. A queer feminist leader who was herself forced to flee from her home country of Jamaica because of who she is. Now based in Canada, Latoya is shaping leadership and empowerment programs for displaced queer and trans people, training newcomers to become spokespeople, advocates, and leaders in their own right. In this episode, we talk about a personal journey, what the world gets wrong about refugees, and why pride must remain political. We explore the global forces driving displacement, the failures of resettlement systems, and how Rainbow Railroad is stepping into the gaps where governments fall short. This is a conversation about identity, resilience, and the power of mission-driven work, about how we support the most vulnerable among us, and what leadership looks like when it's born from lived experience. This is Mission Critical. Let's get into it.
Latoya, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm so happy you're in the studio, and I'm so happy that we're having our chat today. I've been such a fan of the organization that you work for and just everything that you and your team are doing. So it is truly an honor to have you guys in the studio and just be able to talk about everything that you're working on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Before we dive into things, just to kind of give everyone some context, are you able to just introduce yourself and just a quick elevator pitch on who you are, what you do at Rainbow Railroad, and ultimately, like, what is it that you are focusing on?
I'm Latoya Nugent. I'm the head of engagement at Rainbow Railroad. I'm a lot of things, but in this context, I will perhaps say that I'm Black, I'm a refugee, I'm queer, and that experience has shaped how I do my work at Rainbow Railroad. It also inspires the programs and initiatives that I push for. And even, you know, back in the Caribbean where I'm from originally, my identity as a woman, as a queer person, also informed how I instituted or pushed for different programs that affected the community that I am a part of. I would say too that a lot of how I show up in the world, you know, a lot of how I show up in my leadership really, I would say, is inspired primarily by my desire to inspire, especially to inspire hope. Mm-hmm. And that is, I know, connected to the fact that I have existed at the margins of society, you know, even in the Caribbean and to some degree here in Canada. And I'm always the person who wants to move from the margins or to move from the periphery into the core. And I bring my community along with me, you know, in the process.
I love that. I mean, and also the world needs a lot of hope. Right now, these days. I mean, all the time, but right now feels like we need a lot of it. And it's just, important to remind ourselves that it does exist,
yeah.
and that you need to fight for it as well. Speaking of fighting for it, so the when this episode comes out, will be in the thick of Pride Month. You know, a lot of people associate Pride Month with, today at least, you know, celebration, parties, parades. And while all that is important, and certainly there is, you know, it plays a role, do you think, from your perspective and the work that you do, that our community and other communities have forgotten what Pride was built on and what it's really supposed to fight for, especially in the political and cultural landscape that we live in today? There's a lot of discourse around the queer community and the impact, you know, and the things that are happening to us.
I don't think we've forgotten. I think it ebbs and flows between celebration and resistance. And sometimes, depending on the political moment, there is more celebration than there is resistance or protest. And other times, there may be more protest or resistance. I think the current moment we find ourselves in calls for more resistance and protest. Mm-hmm. But I'd never want us to forget the celebration, because queer joy is something that I think the community thrives on. Right? Yes, it's important, it's critical for us to resist and to continue to protest and to push for the changes that we need to thrive as a community. All of the intersecting identities that we find within our community, that is important. But if we focus on that alone, you know, apart from burnout, I'm not sure how sustainable that is for the community. And the celebration for me has a lot of hopefulness mm-hmm. in it, and that joy, you know, it's fuel for me. With the exception of the heat, June is perhaps one of my favorite months in Canada because of Pride, because of how I see the community show up for each other mm-hmm. and how, you know, we sometimes pause to recognize all of the different identities and the different cultures, you know, that exist within the queer community, especially here in Toronto. And so it's always both, but I've found that depending on the political climate or the political moment, you know, it may swing, you know, a little bit more on one side or the other.
Yeah, because there is, in some ways, like a symbiotic relationship between joy and resistance, celebration and protest, but also obviously a tension between the two, because, you know, some years you may want to lean more into one area than the other, and other years it may feel like a mandatory requirement to make sure that we're reminding ourselves about the work that still needs to be done, and also not regressing
as well, right?
Progress is so important, but don't want to regress in the progress.
And even when I talk about the political moment, it's not only what's happening in Canada, because globally, the queer community also looks to what's happening in Canada, or looks to Canada for hope. And so even if things are going great here, if they're not going so well, you know, down south or in other places in the world, seeing this celebration, seeing the community come together, you know, in Canada specifically for Pride in Toronto, that is also, you know, something that I think when you're contemplating the global queer movement, that is something that I think is also important in how we celebrate and how we resist and protest mm-hmm. during Pride.
With regards to the work that you do, given that so much of your work is, you know, liaising and working with people that are outside of Canada, how important is the visibility and the visibility around joy and celebration when it comes to, how do I want to phrase this? How important is it to be visible about joy and celebration when we're talking to other communities that exist outside of Canada?
Mm-hmm. So my portfolio actually requires me to do both, you know, work with folks outside of Canada and folks who are here as well after they relocate. The word that comes to mind when I hear that question is solidarity. Mm-hmm. Solidarity is so powerful. I know sometimes we use it a lot, and it may mean different things to different people, right? But when you live in a country or in a region where it's difficult for you to find hope, where it's difficult for you to find community or to be in community as a queer person, when you see people online who look like you, sound like you, have similar experiences like you, who love like you, there is something in that that I believe, you know, allows people or creates room for people to be hopeful. Hopeful in the sense that they can try to create that in their own space if it is safe to do so. And for those who are in need of relocation, hopeful that on the other side, this is what they can expect. This is what their life experience, you know, could eventually become. And, you know, I was sharing recently with someone after, you know, we decided on our theme for Pride this year, which is Solidarity in Pride, Dare to Resist, that it wasn't until I had the experience of being arrested in Jamaica for my activism that I understood in real practical terms what solidarity means. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, because I lost consciousness when I was in prison for a short time. And after that, I heard of all the stories, the letters that were written by organizations across the Caribbean, activists, academics, organizations, even here in Canada, you know, and I read all of that, and I was like, yeah, this is solidarity. And it drives something in you to keep going even when it is hard, even when you are experiencing your deepest, darkest moments. You know, I, as recently as last year, I have read some of those letters that were written in solidarity of me, you know, several years ago. So I know it makes a difference, and I've had enough conversations with folks who've had really difficult experiences, and when they see how the community shows up for them, even people they don't know personally, but there's something about queerness that brings people together, and you know, we demonstrate our solidarity, I think, perhaps in the most meaningful ways than any other community that I've seen. And so, you know, it really does make a difference, and I bring that, I think about that, I have that in the back of my mind, you know, when I'm interacting with folks who either just arrive in Canada or folks who are about to take, you know, that journey to relocate to Canada or another country, because it does make a difference, you know, and that is what community is about. That is what makes you feel like you belong. So, yeah.
I love that. When you're working with people who are about to make that journey to Canada or the States, what are some of the kind of common questions or curiosities that people have about moving to a country as it relates to their queer identity?
So that's an interesting question. People will have, the questions people will have will depend on how much cable news they watch back home and how active they are on social media, because there is a perception of every country online, right? And sometimes that perception is accurate, sometimes it's not wholly accurate. So that's one thing. There are usually a lot of questions about the immigration process, depending on the pathway that somebody is going to relocate through. So, you know, we'll get a lot of immigration-related questions. Okay, what will the process involve? What do I actually have to do? You know, what are some things I should be aware of? You know, a lot of folks are often relocating to cultures that will be different, financial systems that will be different, you know, laws, rules, regulations that will be different. And so sometimes you'll get questions related to, you know, what they should expect. There are also questions about the weather, because a lot of people are coming from, you know, different kind of climates. And so you'll get a lot of questions, especially if folks are coming from countries where they've perhaps never experienced winter.
Yeah, before, you need resources, you know, for that.
Yeah, exactly. And so just wanting to understand you know, what are the real life implications of mm-hmm. that. Sometimes, especially if people are arriving close to Pride, you'll get questions about that because they would have seen photos and videos and, you know, all of that jazz on TV or online, mm-hmm. etc. And then there's also, you know, curiosity around how easy it will be for them to integrate. For some people who are relocating to a country where the language they speak is not necessarily the official language or mm-hmm. languages of the country where they're going to. And so, you know, you'll get a lot of questions around how difficult it is to learn the language and what they need to do to prepare mm-hmm. and what kind of job opportunities or educational opportunities may be available for them depending on their language skill set, etc. So you get all sorts of questions. You know, you'll even get questions about whether they can hold their partner's hand in public. Because, again, they're coming from places where they may not have been able to do that or feel safe enough to do that.
Questions that seem seemingly simple for a lot of people, but are actually very complex.
Yeah. You know, because the thing with the queer refugees is they're often relocating alone. So they don't really have the security of family with them on that journey. And not many, some people may relocate to cities where there is some familiarity. They've either visited before or maybe they know a few people there, but that's not the case for a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. You know, they become strangers overnight. That's just mm-hmm. the reality. And folks are always curious about the resources that are available wherever they are going and, you know, where they can go to find community as fast as possible mm-hmm. because that's a big part of why they're relocating, right? Some of the data that we collect from folks, you know, has made us realize that the number one challenge that people experience in their home countries is community rejection. And so we know that search for community is top of mind for many people when mm-hmm. they're relocating.
Yeah, and the support systems.
Yes.
Okay, I want to take a few steps back mm-hmm. as well before we go too deep into the work that you're doing. But for listeners who aren't familiar, can you just say, like, what is Rainbow Railroad? What is the mission and the impact that the organization has had?
Rainbow Railroad is a global charitable organization. And the simplest way to explain our mission is that we help at-risk LGBTQI+ people find safety. That's the simplest way to explain it. That means a lot of things. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work. We've been around since 2006. We were founded here in Canada by volunteers. We later became a registered entity, you know, both in Canada and the U.S. We'll celebrate 20 years come next year. And we've done, I would say, a significant amount of work, you know, as part of the response to the global forced displacement crisis. Because our work really lies at the intersection of the criminalization of queer identities and forced displacement. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work that happens globally around forced displacement, but not sufficient work is happening at that intersection. And, you know, as a global organization, we occupy a strong leadership position globally in that fight against persecution and violence that queer people experience because of their identity and the resulting forced displacement that may occur because of the persecution that they experience. Mm-hmm. So that's really, you know, the intersection of our work. And because of that, apart from providing core services and programs for individuals who are at risk, including relocation, we also have to engage in advocacy because we recognize that not everyone will be able to relocate. We can't possibly bring everyone from, you know, countries where they're criminalized to countries like Canada where they can live with dignity and freedom. Part of our work also involves building strong partnerships with grassroots organizations in many countries where queer people are criminalized so that they can engage in the frontline advocacy that is necessary to change the legislative frameworks, the policy frameworks, and the cultural attitudes of the communities, you know, in the places where they live. So we take a very community-driven approach to our work, both here in Canada or in the countries where we're facilitating relocation, as well as in the countries where people are often fleeing from, and these are often countries where LGBTQ plus people are criminalized, or even if they are not criminalized or punished for who they love, or, you know, punished for their sexual behavior, they experience a lot of discrimination, mm-hmm. And violence, sometimes at the hands of their own family members, at the hands of the community. They experience discrimination in law, in policy, mm-hmm. you know, in employment, in housing, education, you name it. And so, you know, the work that we do around relocation is informed by what we see on the ground, what's happening to queer people in many of these places. We also do a lot of crisis monitoring, because one of the things that has been happening, especially since the past 5 or so years, is wherever there is a crisis in the world, we see a corresponding surge or, you know, increase in the requests for help, mm-hmm. even if the crisis that's happening is not targeting the queer community specifically, but queer people are going to be affected by other geopolitical crises too. And so, yeah. You know, what we're seeing in our data, particularly over the past 5 years, is that there's that strong correlation. And so crisis monitoring has become a critical part of the work that we do, because we can then make proactive and strategic decisions about how we can engage in these countries. And that also makes the partnership work that we do with folks globally very important to informing, you know, the ways that we can facilitate interventions, whether it's with, global networks that we are a part of, or sometimes through direct relationships with governments.
Right. I'm sure that this is a very complex and nuanced question, but from, you know, if you can explain maybe from like a bird's eye point of view, what is involved, or how complex is it to relocate someone from a country to another, as, you know, under your stewardship? I'm sure that it's very complicated and there's so many considerations, but how can our audience understand what is the work that's involved to do that?
Yeah, complex is the most appropriate word, and I would add necessary. It's complex, but it's necessary. Mm-hmm. So we have different relocation pathways. Some relocation pathways are in partnership with the government. So we have a strong relationship with the Canadian government, and through that relationship, we've been able to advocate for dedicated pathways for LGBTQ plus people to be able to relocate to Canada. We also have our emergency travel support program. And so what happens with the programs that we have in partnership with the government is that all of the processing of refugees happens before they arrive in Canada. That can often take months or years. Mm. With our emergency travel support program, individuals actually make an asylum claim when they get to Canada or to the country where they're relocating to. So the asylum process, regardless of whether you start in your home country or if you start in a transit country, you know, so a country that you may travel to temporarily while you await final mm-hmm. resettlement, it takes a long time. In very few instances will it take months. Most times it actually takes years. Mm-hmm. You know, I came through the emergency travel support program, so I made an asylum claim after I got to Canada, but I'm still in that process. And I got here, you know, November of 2022, and it's now 2025.
Yeah.
Because it does take a while to complete that process, you know. And for those who are coming through the government pathways, they have to spend years, you know, in transit countries waiting for all of the processing to take place. So the medical processing, the security processing, you know, all of the interviews that you have to do, mm-hmm. all of that, you know, it takes a very long time. And the reality is that, you know, immigration, even though there is such need and demand for relocation pathways, the reality is that governments are not going to facilitate the relocation of even 0.1% of the people who need it, right? That's just the reality. Mm-hmm. So even the folks who actually get to relocate, you know, sometimes it feels like a privilege. It really shouldn't, but it feels like a privilege because if you think about the global context of over 122 million people experiencing forced displacement, and you know, a country like Canada is accepting a few hundred thousand refugees, you know, in a given year, you recognize that many people who are actually in need of relocation don't get to access.
It's like you have like a golden ticket almost.
Right, yeah. You know, and even when you qualify or you're eligible for asylum or refugee status, getting to that point does take a lot of bureaucratic processing.
Yeah.
But can I tell you something? It's mm-hmm. worth it. It's hard, but it's worth it because for me and for, you know, many people I know who've gone through a similar or related process, you know, after a few years of being able to live in a community that affirms who you are, believes in your expertise and your ability and what you can bring to the community, or, you know, appreciates the ways that you can contribute, like it makes a difference, you know, it makes a difference in how you're able to show up. And so yes, it is difficult. I wish I mean, personally, I don't think it needs to be that difficult, and I wish it wasn't, but mm-hmm. you know, that's the reality, you know, the reams of paperwork that you have to file in this process. It's incredible.
Yeah,
it really is incredible. But the thing that bothers me the most about the length of the process, specifically for LGBTQ+ refugees, is for those who have to live in refugee camps for a while, for example, they often experience discrimination and violence because there's this idea that they don't deserve asylum. There's a narrative in the forced displacement space that if you're fleeing war or climate disaster, you know, or some other kind of crisis, you deserve.
Right. There's a hierarchy almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of need and, yeah.
Right. And, you know, people become refugees because they're forced to flee home. That's mm-hmm. the bottom line. Mm-hmm. But for queer refugees, they often, like, you know, we often become refugees. We often are forced to flee home because of something that's personal to us. It's because of who we love. It's because of who we are. And it's because of where we're born. Because we're born in places that do not respect or dignity as people because we're queer. Mm-hmm. And there's something, especially, you know, because we know what's happening in a lot of the refugee camps, and there's something about that personal experience of your queerness and how it causes displacement that folks within the forced displacement space don't quite understand or even appreciate, and so, you know,
yeah.
you know, you're right. The word is probably hierarchy,
right?
You know. And it also makes it more difficult for a lot of queer refugees because they have to, quote unquote, prove that they deserve to live with dignity.
You know, that's interesting because later in this conversation, I wanted to talk about just misconceptions and myths around the dialogue around being a refugee, but it didn't really occur to me that that is a dialogue internally as well within the refugee community too. And that's, you know, it, when you talk about it, it makes sense to me, and I understand how that would come about. And, you know, when people's basic needs aren't being met, it just, I can see how there might be a perception of a hierarchy based off of needs and perception, but it did not occur to me. Mm-hmm. So the other thing too that I was thinking about as you were talking about the process of, you know, just how long it can take is just the sense of closure, when you're able to get a sense of closure throughout this whole process. But to your point, it's all worth it. And, you know, even though, even in your experience, that process is not necessarily finished, at least you get to live fully and your identity gets to be respected and you can, you know, contribute as and be valued as a person that is contributing to the community too. It's
you exhale, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And as I talk about exhale, I remember when I just got here in November 2022 and a couple of folks at Rainbow Railroad, you know, met me at the airport and we did a quick video. And I, you know, a few years up to that point, I became silent because they, you know, like, it was next to impossible for me to continue living in Jamaica because of what I, you know, had experienced, you know, given the violent nature mm-hmm. of the arrest a few years before. And when I got to the airport, and I was, I just started chatting with folks at Rainbow Railroad. And I don't remember what the first question was. I just remember smiling in my response mm-hmm. because there was so much joy and so much relief. And I was prepped and all of that. And, you know, but I still couldn't know exactly what my life would be in Canada, right? But there's just that ability to exhale and just...
Very liberating.
Yeah, you know, and I don't think I'll ever be able to explain it in an articulate way because it was so much about what I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And feeling proud of myself for even wanting to speak in that moment because I became silent, you know, for so long. And I was like, yeah, I'm here. I'm just going to let go. I have nothing to worry about anymore. Yes, the process is going to be long and hard, but I know what is possible at the end, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of that process. And I also appreciate will appreciate all of the small wins in between.
That's important too, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I can only do this work from a place of optimism. Because if I don't do this work from a place of optimism, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know, what's the point? It's mission driven work. And you have to be continuously inspired.
Yeah.
And to be hopeful to continue to work towards the mission.
The other thing too is that to your point earlier, it takes a lot of courage to, you know, you talk about being silent and, you know, I imagine just the trauma from the lived experiences, but it takes courage to be able to, one, live your truth, and two, to advocate for yourself and to make decisions that may ultimately be very uncomfortable or difficult and painful, but ultimately in the long term, the long run, is going to be better for you. And that's what everyone, or a lot of people, I'm sure, going through your organization are experiencing, that same kind of feeling of exhalation when they, you know, are able to feel like they can live fully as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you now lead refugee leadership programs and the Queer Refugee Internship Initiative. What gaps are you trying to close in the Canadian resettlement system?
Yeah, so let me start with the Queer Refugee Internship Program. many people who relocate, you know, they're coming with education from their home countries, skills, like years of, you know, working in a particular sector. But there's something, I think, that about Canadian employers, not all of them, but some Canadian employers believe that you need to demonstrate some work experience here in Canada before, you know, they will pay attention to your other qualifications.
Sure.
I'm not sure exactly what's behind it, but that has been something that many refugees have spoken about, you know, that it's difficult for them to land a job, even though they may have the requisite education and skills, but because they have it in a different context, you know, they're coming from a different region, etc., there's this belief that the skills are not transferable immediately to the Canadian context. And so we decided last year that we would pilot what we call the Queer Refugee Internship Program. And we would put out a call for interns to work with us for about 12 weeks in areas where they're already skilled in, you know, skills they're bringing from their home country, and also in areas that will meet the needs of the organization. Mm-hmm. The pilot was very successful, and we decided, okay, we're going to institute this as a part of what we do at Rainbow Railroad. This year, we're even going to expand it further. We're going to bring some of our community partners along and encourage them to hire refugees as interns. We received funding to expand that. So we will be working with our partners to put out a call for different positions depending on the need of those organizations. And through that partnership, they will be placed at the respective organizations, and then Rainbow Railroad would sort of manage the logistics mm-hmm. of all of that. Beyond that, we also want to bring some of our corporate partners involved. We want to encourage them to also have a refugee internship program where they you know, bring on refugees as interns in their own companies so that we can just face the reality that many employers want people to have Canadian experience, and we are the facilitators of, you know, creating that experience so that they can, it will be a faster track or easier for them to actually, you know, earn full-time employment or gain full-time employment opportunities after that internship. Or for some people, it may also lead them to pursue a particular educational path, you know, after the internship program. So that is the gap that it's filling, and we expect over the next 3 to 5 years that we will scale that program and have more community organizations and more companies actually, you know, hiring refugee interns so that they can, you know, advance their career. So, yeah. So that's what that's about.
That's great. That's great. What, you know, I mentioned this earlier. What are some of the myths and misconceptions around refugees, and not necessarily just queer refugees, but just the general discourse around that? Do you find that there's a through line in a lot of conversations that are happening out there?
Yeah.
And still a lot that needs to be broken down and unpacked?
So that's the internship program, and that's really about creating employment opportunities and building, you know, supporting the professional development of refugees. We also have the Queer Refugee Ambassador Program. Mm-hmm. And that is focusing a lot on community advocacy. Because in the queer community here, there isn't as much advocacy that's been driven by people who have lived experience of forced displacement. And so we want to build people's capacity to be able to take up space, you know, in that kind of advocacy. And then for in terms of the immigration advocacy that happens, there isn't enough voices from queer refugees in those spaces. So we're trying to fill two gaps, right? Mm-hmm. And so we build, some people, you know, they arrive with the experience of being activists in their home country. And so it's easy, but there are others who, because of their journey as a refugee or because of their experience with forced displacement, they want to use that experience the launch pad for getting involved in more activism. And so mm-hmm. we created the Queer Refugee Advocacy Program so that there will be opportunities for these individuals to actively engage in community activism as well as policy advocacy where possible. And the final one, which I'm particularly excited about, is our Queer Refugee Community Support Network. This it really uses a community of practice model. Folks who would have relocated with Rainbow Railroad support over the years, and folks who may not necessarily have relocated with our support, but they're connected, you know, they've connected with the organization since relocating. They utilize their own journey and their in-country skill set to support newly arrived mm-hmm. refugees and to help to prepare refugees who will arrive in the future.
Yeah, like an ambassadorship.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes a world of difference, because I mentioned at the top that people are relocating to communities where they don't know anyone, you know, and they become strangers overnight. And so if you are welcomed by people who went through a similar
totally.
Kind of experience, and yep. they understand the pitfalls, they understand, you know, how to help you navigate systems. Like, if you can have that at your disposal, it will enhance the relocation experience, and it will enhance how well you're able to integrate into, you know, the new communities. And I'm excited about it, because I know the difference that it can make when you have a few people in your corner from day one to support you.
And who have lived through the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And can kind
so
of...
they can provide advice and that sort of thing.
And you learn from their experiences.
Yeah.
To make it better.
Yeah.
And even just anecdotal kind of experiences and things, advice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then to your point too, just establishing a community.
Yeah.
And a foundation that does not exist, especially if you're by yourself. I can't imagine just how overwhelming of an experience that must be for someone, because not only do you, like, moving to another city is hard enough within your own country, if you don't have, like, a support group of friends, family, whatever it might be, but to move to a different country where there's a different culture, mm-hmm. a different language, and then to not have a support system, like, I just cannot imagine how... overwhelming and difficult that must be. So, you know, to have people who have lived through it and are examples of what the other end looks like,
yeah.
and how that can, you know, how you can get there, I think must feel very empowering.
It is.
You
it
know?
Is. Yeah. And, you know, these refugee leadership and empowerment programs are important. And a lot of it, I know, is inspired by my own approach to leadership, you know, and I always believe that the people who are often most affected by the mission should drive,
mm-hmm.
you know, that work. And these programs are a way for Rainbow Railroad to do that. And it also builds credibility within the community, you know, and all of these programs require partnerships.
Right.
You know, and that I think is also important in any kind of mission-driven work.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the misconceptions around the dialogue when it comes to everything that you're working on? What are the things that you still find continue to be a through line and continue to be misconceptions that need to really be broken down and unpacked?
So two things happen almost in every conversation you have about refugees. One, they're a security threat. Two, they're a strain on the resources of the countries they are relocating to. So I'll take the first one, the security threat. This idea that people are fleeing to Canada to, you know, cause harm to others is a misconception. People become refugees because they're forced to flee home.
Yeah.
That's just the reality. It's as simple as that. And when you're forced to flee your home and you are able to relocate to a country like Canada, what you're trying to do when you get here is to rebuild your life.
Mm-hmm.
And there is enough hardship in that. And so I think when that narrative is, perpetuated by, whether it's folks in media or people in the community or even policymakers, it stings. You know, it really stings because at least every refugee I know, they are probably trying to work two times as hard as they would, because there is so much that you have to sort of catch up on.
Yeah.
Because you're rebuilding your, especially if you relocate, older, like if you're over 35, it there's a lot of catching up to do. Yeah.
It's not like people want to put themselves in a position to to have to catch up and have to displace themselves.
Yeah.
Why would anyone choose that if they have the option?
Nobody chooses displacement.
Yeah. That's
why we call it forced displacement, so people can understand very clearly, that this is not something that people choose for themselves. And specifically for queer refugees, because we've been discarded by, our communities back home, we're looking for that here, So we're looking to rebuild our lives, and we're looking for community to recreate what it means to have a home and to belong. And then the other thing about the strain on the economy, this is often, the root of it, I think, is in the fact that oftentimes in the first, few months, in some instances, the first couple of years, the community and the government needs to invest a little bit in supporting individuals with integration.
Getting people on their feet.
Right.
Yeah.
It's short term, And the return on investment is great. Rainbow Railroad spent maybe about $7,000 to get me here in Canada. I think I've donated more than that to Rainbow Railroad already.
Mm-hmm.
I've paid enough taxes to cover all the support that the government poured into me in the initial few months. But it's a scapegoating thing, right? Refugees, I don't know, make up just the smallest fraction possible of the population in Canada. But, it's easy, I think, to attempt to blame refugees for the social ills, because it means you don't have to take responsibility for, any of the policy decisions that you made or did not make that has led to some of the social challenges that we're experiencing. But, seriously, I wish that there was more compassion in our communities for refugees to understand the reality of why they were forced to flee home, to understand the support that is needed, especially initially, to help them, to help us to get on our feet, and that we thrive after.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying everybody will have exactly the same experience and everybody will be successful to the same degree, but I can tell you categorically that refugees are looking to create opportunities for themselves to thrive here. Because for queer refugees, Yes, safety is important, but I have learned that safety is not just the absence of violence. Mm-hmm. It's not just the absence of the violence that you would have been experiencing back home. It's also the presence of community, the presence of home, the presence of belonging. And the ability to exhale and to believe.
And succeed.
Yes.
Yes.
And to believe that you can imagine a reality where you will have a prosperous future. Mm-hmm. All of those things matter.
Yeah.
You know, when I think about safety, those things matter. You know, that is the hope you have for yourself after you relocate. And it takes time. Mm-hmm. It won't happen in a week or two. And for some people, it may take, you know, a little while longer. I'm, 2.5 years in, and there's still work that I need to do. And there's still more that I want to achieve, you know. But where I am today in 2025 is a far cry from where I was in 2023,
yeah.
You know, or where I was at my 2-year anniversary or my 1-year anniversary. It takes time. And what we need as refugees is the space and the grace to gift this future to ourselves, because we will do the work. Of course, we need a leg up or some assistance in the first few months, but yeah, we'll soar after that. And like I said, the return on investment is great, and I really would wish people would stop, you know, perpetuating the narrative that we are a strain on the economy. We're not. We contribute billions of dollars in taxes annually. Yeah. And according to CRA data, we actually have the highest tax compliance as a category of people.
Right. There's an economic discussion there, too. The other thing, too, is that, like, it shouldn't be seen as an audacious, you know, thing to want more than just safety for yourself. You, how dare people want to also have success beyond safety, you know, and be able to dream and hope for that for themselves too, right? Yeah.
And my hope is that the more of us who become successful and we are open about it, that the more it will shift the narratives that, mm-hmm. you know, we have about refugees.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is, like, when we talk about refuge, you know, not all safe countries, or how do I phrase this? Are all safe countries safe for queer people? Is, you know, how does that conversation play into the considerations and the experiences of the people that you're working with? What have you seen firsthand? And what are the challenges for people? Obviously, much different from if they're, you know, trying to leave a country where it is not safe for them. But also, it's just because you're moving to a country that is safer, what are also the considerations for the queer community and queer individuals moving to a country like Canada?
Yeah, so for Canada specifically, it's race. Mm. Many of the people who are often in need of relocation are Black people of color. Mm-hmm. And we're often coming from countries or regions where we are not racialized.
Right.
But when we come to Canada, we become racialized. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of duality in that, where you experience the safety of your queerness, like it's safe to be queer. But then you have to navigate some complexities around your race.
Mm-hmm. So that Canada, you've never had to really to confront before.
You have to learn that. I've had to learn that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, thankfully, I haven't had to learn it from negative experiences.
Sure.
But I've had to understand what it means to be a Black woman who is a refugee in Canada. Mm-hmm. There's something different about that, you know, than being in the Caribbean, where I was a Black queer woman, where over 90% of the population is also, you know, Black.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of duality in it, because sometimes it feels like you may have potentially given up one type of discrimination for another. But again, that is dependent on the experiences that you have here. Mm-hmm. But there are some systemic issues. We know this. Every social challenge disproportionately affects Black, queer refugees in Canada. Homelessness, mm-hmm. employment, all of it. Bad credit. And so there's a complexity in that we have to navigate. And we don't have all of the solutions, with the exception of targeted, intentional programs to raise awareness, to build capacity, both for the refugees themselves and the people, in the communities where they're living. And so that also looks like building or creating more awareness within the queer community here, so that the queer community creates room and space for refugees, for Black refugees, for people of color who are refugees in that queer space.
Yeah.
Understanding that the experiences of these individuals will be different from somebody who would have lived through, 40 years of queer liberation in Canada. It's hard work. It's difficult work. Sometimes it makes you question the work, because you realize that there's a lot to do here in the community that need to make it more inclusive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're like, mm-hmm. why? I just had to navigate the complexity of getting here, of supporting people to get here. Why do we have this other layer of complexity that we have to now navigate? It shows up in different ways. It also shows up at the, intersection of financial wellness, because what I found is for the refugees, regardless of their race, for the refugees who've been able to thrive financially, it's easier for them to find and access the queer community here than it is for people who take a longer time to find that financial independence and mm-hmm. security. Mm-hmm. So there's so many layers, and unfortunately there aren't enough programs to address all of these.
It's so complex.
Layers, yeah. It really is. I focus a lot, personally and with the people who are in my circle, I focus a lot on the financial wealth. But that's because of my upbringing. That's because of my dad. That's something he drilled into his three daughters all our lives. I was getting stocks for gifts when I was 6 or 7 years old. I wasn't getting dogs, And so one of the things I did early was, even before I arrived, I did so much research on the financial system here. Mm. Because I knew it would be the gateway to building, the life and the future that I imagined for myself after being here, maybe for about 25 years or so, because I'm thinking about when I become 60 and I retire, like what I want my life to be.
Sure.
But it's a lot to learn. It's a lot to understand.
People who are born here and have come up through like Canada or any other country also don't even have a grasp on that.
I know. You are right. I have folks who they've either lived here for much longer than me or they were born here. And sometimes I'm having some, you know, financial conversations with them and they're like, what are you talking about? Like,
yeah.
I didn't know that that existed.
Exactly.
You know, so it's, but it's a lot, you know. Mm. But the thing I always lean into the most, though, is if you are able to access the information that you need to make life better for yourself and your community, there's a lot that is possible. Mm-hmm. Because in some of those very conversations, you know, that I reference, I've seen how transformative they've been for a lot of people, how they think about their finances differently. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a pet project that I want to you know, get off the ground maybe next year and in the next 2 years, where I work with a community organization to help queer refugees to build, you know, a strong foundation for their financial independence, you know.
And literacy around it, yeah.
Yeah, because that's all it takes, you know. You don't, like, these aren't things you necessarily learn overnight or anything like that. But the information is there and it's very accessible, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. it will take some discipline. That's another thing that I know that many refugees struggle with, like the discipline, because there's so much freedom here. Mm-hmm. There's so mm-hmm. much you can do and you want to do it all right away, but it requires discipline and thinking long term, you know, even if you live short term, but you have to think long term. if what you really want is a sustainable, prosperous future for yourself,
You know, a lot of the conversation and dialogue that we've had, you know, focuses a lot on a lot of the struggle and hardship that people have gone through in order to have the audacity to live a full life and an honest life. You know, just as we kind of tail off here, what are just some of the milestones in progress and benchmarks that you personally or you as an organization have surpassed that have really shown that the work is mm-hmm. meaningful, the work is growing, the impact is growing? Are there any examples that you can kind of bring up?
I'll start with the organization first. Over the past 5 or so years, our requests for help numbers have increased by about 300%. And it's not something that we celebrate, it's something that we recognize, because mm-hmm. It means that more people know where they can turn to for help.
Yeah.
And that's important. Especially because we know that an organization like Rainbow Railroad is often the last resort for many people. So that's one. Since our founding in 2006, we've assisted over 20,000 people through a suite of programs, not just relocation. That's a big number for us. In the last 10 years, we've raised over $65 million to support this work. And my vision for the organization is that we're going to double that in 5 years.
Manifest.
Yes, I'm manifesting it. We have partnered with scores of organizations doing work on the front line in difficult places. And they are seeing and experiencing change in some of these communities. That's progress, in my mind. Last year alone, over 38,000 hours were donated to the organization from volunteers. Mm. That's perhaps the equivalent of 18 additional members of staff working full-time for a year.
Right.
Yeah. And because of that time investment, we've been able to enhance the quality of our work. We've been able to support more people. Last year, we supported 5,886 people. And we've been able to improve the quality of care, support, and services that we're able to deliver to people. So we are seeing more investment from the community in the work that we do, and that is translating into the tangible transformation of people's lives, and we're able to get more LGBTQI plus people out of life-threatening danger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We've also achieved a remarkable, historic partnership with the Canadian government. We are the only nonprofit organization outside of the UN system that has a direct referral partnership with a G7 government. The only organization Wow. in the world that has that kind of partnership. That was advocacy, day and night, to create a dedicated pathway for LGBTQI plus refugees, because we know how difficult it is for LGBTQI plus refugees to access relocation, to access resettlement. That's major.
Mm-hmm.
Our leadership and our credibility globally and with the community that we serve, that continues to improve. And that is important for the sustainability of the work. We talk about queering the system and queer liberation. Those things can only happen if the community is at the center, because it is the community that will make all of that work sustainable. Mm. And the work has to be sustainable for as long as it is needed. We don't want it to be needed, but for as long as it is needed, it needs to be sustainable. And we are seeing, or we have seen over the years, that Rainbow Railroad has become more sustainable, more credible. And that, I think, those things are big wins
yeah.
for the organization. personally, this may sound silly. I say two things. I can walk anywhere at any time of the day for however long I want. I couldn't do that in Jamaica and feel safe.
Mm.
And I literally walk everywhere. Unless I have to dress up.
Yeah.
And then if I have to dress up, I have to wear fancy shoes, and then I don't want to walk.
Practical considerations. Right. Yes.
Outside of that,
yeah.
And I don't dress up often. But outside of that, in a 40-minute radius, mm-hmm. I'm walking.
Mm.
So I walk to work every day. I walk from work. I walk by the lake. If I have some event and I don't have to dress up, I walk. And I just, on my walks, especially, early in the morning, I experience the freedom to be who I am. On a lot of my walks, especially if I'm walking by the lake, I often look out and, that place where the sun kisses the lake,
mm.
and there's this infinite kind of radiance and mm-hmm. peace, like I feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And I look forward to feeling that when I've done all of this work and I retire at 60, living in my small home in the country, somewhere mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. the lake. Mm-hmm. And I look out at my window and I think about all of what I would have contributed in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, in Canada, and what it means for the community that I serve, because I am the community that I serve. So that's one. And the other thing is my credit score.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever spoken about this publicly, but I am so proud of the fact that in 2.5 years, I got my credit score to over 800. That thing has been on my mind since I've been here and learning about credit scores and what it means and what you can access. And yeah. I've just been working towards getting it over 800. And I hit it earlier this year, and I celebrated, and I talked about it to myself almost every day for a few weeks.
I love that.
So yeah, those are my two things.
You know, they're not silly, and it is the simple things are sometimes the biggest things, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm so happy for you. You talked about the amount of volunteer hours that the organization has received through people wanting to contribute their time, their efforts. Just as a last question here, what is the best way that people can help out the organization, whether that's through donation, sponsorship, volunteering? How and in what ways can people help?
There are a lot of ways that people can help the organization. I'm always going to start with money. Mm-hmm. Always.
Money talks.
Yeah. So people can donate to the organization. They can go to our website and donate directly. For the entire month of Pride, we'll be running our Solidarity in Pride campaign. And we have a target of raising $1.6 million by midnight June 30th. And we're going to hit that target. And we need the community to help us to hit that target. Mm. So people can go on our website and they can donate. They can also donate proceeds of sales. You know, small businesses can decide that they want to contribute a portion of their sales to the organization. People can host events and, you know, donate the proceeds to Rainbow Railroad. Auction, you know, like there's anything that can, you know, bring in revenue. Yeah, there's a way you can donate those funds to Rainbow Railroad to support this life transforming work that we do. People can also continue to volunteer with the organization. You know, I mentioned the kind of impact that, you know, volunteer time can have on the work. Follow us, engage us on social media, because that's, I know we say it all the time, but it actually makes a difference. The more people understand the work, understand why it's important, mm-hmm. understand what's happening in the world, the more they can have conversations with people in their own networks.
Visibility.
You know, about the work and why it is important. And they can also have conversations with their elected officials so that elected officials can be aware of what's happening with the community and what's important to their constituents. So, you know, those are some of the ways that people can donate to the organization. We are also, for Pride, running this Messages of Solidarity campaign, where people can write a message of solidarity to an LGBTQI+ person who may be at risk, you know. And I think something like that is really beautiful, because when you read those messages as somebody who needs hope to survive, it's something for you to hold on to. And so,
day by day,
you know, I would encourage folks to participate in that campaign.
And not feel so alone.
Right, yeah.
And so when people want to volunteer, how can they volunteer? Is that through, like, what are the ways that people...
So there are a lot of ways that folks can volunteer. We provide post-relocation support to individuals. And what we try to do is leverage the queer community here. And so we ask people to volunteer maybe 2 to 3 hours of their time each week for a few months to support somebody who newly arrived to Canada, and to be that supportive network, almost an extended family for a queer newcomer, you know, just to help in the initial few months with integration, help them navigate, you know, some of the complexities of our provincial or federal bureaucracy, and to find community, connect them to your own networks, you know, help them find a healthcare provider. We know that's a struggle all around. Help them to secure, you know, more permanent housing, and just to be, you know, someone they can rely on, you know, to help them to understand a little bit more about what it's like to to live and thrive in Canada and to make smart decisions too, you know, because as people who, you know, would have lived here for a much longer period, they may have a bit more insight into, you know, what it means, what it takes for you to thrive, and just imparting that knowledge, you know, can be very helpful for somebody who is new to Canada.
So,
yeah. And of course, there are other ways, you know, we have events. I'm hoping that you're coming to Freedom Party. You're coming to Freedom Party,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yes. So that's our major fundraising event happening on June 6th at the ROM. So, you know, when we have events like that or when we have smaller events, it's always helpful when people offer to volunteer. So they work the event with our staff. And, you know, sometimes in our donor communications, it's helpful to have volunteers to support some of that work. And so there are lots of different ways that people can volunteer their time. And you can just go to our website, rainbowrailroad.org, and you hit that volunteer button and sign up, and somebody will be in touch with you.
I love that.
Yeah.
Natalia, you've given me so much time and insight and so much of your incredible energy today. So thank you so much for just sharing your story and sharing the story and the mission of the organization, and just reminding people that, one, they have the ability to contribute and help, and then two, that there's, you know, hope and living examples of people that have realized that. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Lance.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go and make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.